Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to a new four-part documentary series called Standing on Sacred Ground, sacred lands are under siege. The Sacred Land Film Project exposes threats to Native people's health, their livelihood, and cultural survival. The films focus on eight indigenous communities around the world that are working to protect their traditional sacred lands from government mega projects, consumer culture, resource extraction, competing religions, tourism, and climate change. Standing on Sacred Ground takes us to five places around the world, including Aboriginal Australia, the Andes of Peru, the Rift Valley in Ethiopia, and Mount Shasta here in Northern California. And in all of these places, there are stories of resistance and hope, and stories of people facing great odds in defense of sacred ground. And here is a clip from the first film.
They've been trying to instruct Indians to be capitalists ever since they got here. But we don't value what you value.
We own the land, we own the water, we own the sky. We own everything. We have to shift our attitude of ownership of nature to relationship with nature. The moment you change from ownership to relationship, you create a sense of the sacred.
And that is a clip from the first film in the new four-part documentary series called Standing on Sacred Ground. So when we talk about sacred ground, what do we mean by sacred? What is sacred land today? How is it valued when it comes to laws that determine how land and resources can be used? I actually just read yesterday that even though there's a government shutdown, all the federal land is closed, but it does not apply to oil and gas extraction on federal land. So we'll also talk about that today. And joining us to talk about these new films is Christopher Toby McLeod. He circled the globe for 7 years filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series. He founded the Sacred Land Film Project at the Earth Island Institute in 1984 to make documentaries relevant to Indigenous communities and modern audiences. His first film was called The Cracking of Glen Canyon Dam with Edward Abbey and Earth First. And Toby joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose.
Great to have you. And Kalene Sisk is the chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe in Northern California. Kalene is currently battling a U.S. proposal to enlarge the Shasta Dam and flood Winnemem sacred sites. Her tribe's history is well documented by anthropologists and recognized by the California Native American Heritage Commission, though they have been considered unrecognized by the United States government since 1985. In 2007, the California State Assembly passed a joint resolution calling on the federal government to formally recognize the Winnemem Wintu tribe. And Kalene is also in studio. Hi, Kalene. Great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So, Toby, you spent 7 years on this project. How was it born? Why did you decide to focus on Indigenous communities fighting to preserve sacred land?
Back in the 1970s and 80s, I got interested in the effects of coal strip mining and uranium mining in Hopi and Navajo country, and went and made a documentary about the physical pollution, birth defects, water pollution, all that carbon and soot going into the air and so forth. And the elders in Hopi, as concerned as they were about the environmental effects, they could not stop talking about this spiritual compact that they have to protect their land, the ancient village sites and shrines, the burial grounds, the mountains that provide the clouds and the water. And so they kept trying to focus me on the spiritual dimension of the environmental crisis and these sacred places that are the touchstone and anchor of their culture. And I didn't get it. I was this blind, Yale-educated, you know, Western young guy. But I think they might have seen that there was a chance that they could kind of win me over. And I've been on this path ever since then, because I did realize that you can feel the emotional commitment and the cultural depth of these sacred places, the importance of them to these different cultures. And so over the years, we made a film some years ago called In the Light of Reverence. My original idea was to do an international series because there are sacred places all around the earth. But lack of funding, lack of cultural concern about this issue led me, I think it was sort of meant to be this way, focus on the United States, this kind of legal entity where Native Americans have these struggles, mm-hmm. tell, in that case, three stories, which one of which was the Winnemem. So that's when I met Colleen and her great aunt, Florence Jones, the great medicine woman from near Mount Shasta. And we documented three American Indian struggles to protect sacred places. 10 years later, there is enough cultural concern. Discussion of what sacred places mean is part of our dialogue. There are people in foundations now, program officers who get it. Mm. Anthropologists are writing books about it. So we were able to raise the money to go and show that there are cultures all around the world trying to protect sacred places. And even though each is unique, they have these incredible, you know, you heard Oren Lyons just now say, you've been trying to turn us into capitalists ever since you got here, but we don't value what you value. That's true all around the world. Mm. The values are reciprocity and respect and non-material values. So we tried to show the uniqueness but the similarities of these struggles.
That's one of my favorite lines in the film. The other thing, Colleen, that really strikes me about this is people are fighting to stop the Keystone Pipeline. They're fighting to raise awareness about fracking. But the spiritual aspects tend to be missing, at least from what I see. And what I liked was, you know, you had lines in the film like sacred spaces are like spiritual recharge areas where we are always careful and prayful. Or our ancestors warned us, a creature from the underworld will emerge. A cold breathing trouble will come. Gas is coming. So what are your thoughts about just the power of sort of stepping back from all of it and thinking like this? How does it change your perspective of the environment?
Well, one of the things that I think that it's innate to us to have that kind of preview to our world. You know, when we are introduced into the world by sacred places, that's sort of instilled to be one of the utmost important. While you can recognize, you know, the health factors and the facts, people can't see the relationship of the larger world. Because, you know, when we go to the river and we go to the spring to pray, it's not just that water, because that water has passed by us already. By the time our prayer has ended, the water has gone and we're praying to new water. But that water goes all over the world. That's what we're praying about.
And when we talk about sacred land or sacred space, what does that mean today at a time when, like I said, federal lands are closed, but gas and oil exploration on federal lands are still taking place?
I think most Americans think that those are the sacred lands. The oil and gas. But I think that if the world is to continue, more people have to kind of open up their view to what the land and water have the relationship with us, and not us controlling and demanding from it always. But what are we giving back?
When I first met Colleen and her Grams, Florence, I went to a ceremony we were trying to film. We were sort of trying to convince them they could trust us and so forth. And we were at Coonrod, one of their summer ceremonies below Mount Shasta. And I was walking towards where Colleen and Florence were under their tarp over there, you know. And I walked by a tent and I heard a native, a Winnemem parent, say to a 2-year-old kid standing outside the tent, "This is sacred land." And I walked by and I just thought, oh, my God, I wish I could hear what came next. Like, what are the rules that you're going to tell this child? And it couldn't help but think that I never heard anything like that as a kid growing up. I got never instruction about what, you know, what is a culturally significant place and what is the story that links my ancestors to this place and gives us a responsibility to take care of it in a certain way. And yet Native cultures have preserved that all over the earth to communicate those values. And it's not it is a material thing. There are places of power. There are places that have the ability to generate weather. And, you know, in Ethiopia, Mako Wario, this spiritual leader, he sacrifices an animal to the mountain. And, of course, they eat the animal. And it's a beautiful ceremony. It wouldn't go over with PETA very well because, you know, but there, this is a way of praying to your food before you take it. And the mountain is sacred because it gives life. It provides the sustenance, the grass, which is, grass just seems so simple, but for them, grass is life. Mm. And manure, they speak so lovingly of manure. But the, it's the source of life. This mountain is sacred because Milo, mountain, gives life. So it's sacred to them. It's, in some ways, it's so simple.
Well, you said when you started this project 7 years ago, you didn't really think of this land as sacred. What did you think about sacred land back then, and how has this experience transformed the way you look at it today?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I know that I have, in my life, there's a place my family, my grandmother lived, Nantucket Island, and I've always had this, you know, connection to the tides and the winds, and, the, you know, I have a place that I've been all my life, and I had a connection. But I noticed, for example, when I would go to a place like Devil's Tower in Wyoming, you know, this incredible rock that just comes up out of the earth, you know, you go there and you just, you feel there's something going on here. And the Park Service back in the day when I first went there in the 80s, there was no information about, you know, this is a geological formation. Years later, you realize it is sacred to 17 plains tribes, and they would, you know, all their ceremonial migrations and the buffalo movement and the way they interpret the stars, it all revolves around this and the Black Hills and Bear Butte. So I just, you know, I know a little more now, and I think one of the reasons is that indigenous people all around the world and Native Americans here have realized over this 30 or 40 years that I've been working on this subject that a taboo, secret subject that is not communicated to the outside world is maybe not the best strategy if you want to protect these places in a consumeristic, extractive world. That, and that's, in the 90s, there was a shift, and Colleen was part of that, from no filming, no talking about sacred places, this is really proprietary information, we need to be really, to letting a little bit out to educate the public about these places are important to us and this is why. And so we're in the middle of a different era now where we're actually talking about it, and that has unintended consequences. That can be a good thing, but it can also lead to New Agers flocking to Mount Shasta or, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Can you talk about that, Colleen? What are the benefits of really sharing your story? And, well, let's talk about that first. And why do you think so many tribes ultimately said, yeah, I think this, it's worth it. Let's do this.
Yeah, I think that we're forced. This is not something that we embraced or we looked for. But we struggle with protecting sacred sites, protecting these places of cultural significance for future generations, and in fear of them not being here for our future generations, kind of opened up to say, okay, just a little bit. And even with Toby coming in and doing the first film with us, I mean, we almost kicked him out because of the uncomfortable. Hmm. Our people were very uncomfortable. It's like, he shouldn't be taking pictures of that and or be here with a camera, you know, or, you know, filming us like this. And so there was a lot of problems within our own ranks to say, we have to allow this to take place if we want our future generations to have something, because at the time, Grams was the leader. And we had to abide by the leader because she has the connection to the one above. And somehow, even though we were all much younger then and opposed greatly, but she was in power and allowed this to happen. And now that we look back at it and we think that it was a good thing now, even though the other side of it was is that people didn't know that our spring was sacred until we said it was sacred, and now they all know that it's sacred. So now they've all invented something that takes them there, but they don't know how to be there. They don't know what to do there, and so they bring with them what they know. And a lot of that is the crystals or Fiji dolls or coconuts or whatever they have, and they leave it in the meadow or they leave it in the water. And that's a problem, because we feel that that place is so sacred that it is the blessing place. We can't do anything there to improve it. We don't leave anything there, and that's our culture is that one of the issues when we were fighting for Mount Shasta against the ski lodge was that there's no artifacts here. There's no evidence that you were here. It's like, that's because it's so sacred that you don't drop anything, you don't leave anything. It's so sacred that you leave it as it was, and you leave. But I don't know. It's something that I don't know how to transmit that to other people. How do they get that something is so sacred that maybe you just look at it
and have a feeling that you can't describe? That is Kalene Sisk. She's chief of the Winneman Wintu tribe. This tribe inhabits ancestral territory from Mount Shasta down to the McLeod River watershed. When the Shasta Dam was constructed during World War II, it completely flooded their home and blocked the salmon runs. The tribe's history is well documented by anthropologists and recognized by the California Native American Heritage Commission, but they've been considered, quote, unrecognized by the U.S. government since 1985. We're also joined by Toby McLeod. He circled the globe for 7 years filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series. And it does debut, it has its premiere tonight through the weekend at the Mill Valley Film Festival. And then there will be special screenings at the David Brower Center on Tuesday the 15th. And it'll be at the Roxy in San Francisco as part of the San Francisco Green Film Fest on the 16th and the 17th. And you can find information about all of the screenings at yourcallradio.org. So what are your thoughts about sacred land? What does that mean in today's time? If you've been involved in trying to preserve sacred land, I know there's movements. It's the Shell Mound in Richmond, right? And then in Emeryville, the mall is on top of burial sites. There were movements to try to stop that. So if you've been involved in any of these, we'd love to hear from you. And in the face of increasing development and oil and gas extraction, how do we protect the places we care about? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you're like Toby and your opinion of sacred land has changed because of maybe an experience you've had, we'd love to hear from you. And if you live near a native site, how is that land being protected if it is? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. So, Kalene, can you talk about some of the sacred sites near the Mount Shasta, McLeod River areas?
The sacred sites that we're a part of are so interconnected. It's like cell towers for us. It's like from the top of Mount Shasta to the Milky Way, to how the salmon find their way back up the river, and then different places all along the watershed that holds the world together, all the way to the bay where the fish come from. So there are particular sites, not just village sites or burial grounds, but particular sites that are empowering to know things, to have knowledge. And that's part of what I think that gets lost in translation is that we go there because we want to know what the future brings. How do we take care of our kids? What are those things that need to be done for our relatives, the trees or the birds or the hummingbirds, you know, the different migratory ones that come through and share these different parts of our life. And when they stop coming through, what do we do? Because right now at Mount Shasta, you go to the spring and you don't hear the birds. There's so many people who go into the spring that there's no place for the birds. There's no place for singing. You know, when you have 30,000 visitors to a spring in a summer, that's too much. And people want to see a beautiful place, but they don't realize that if you keep doing that, it's not going to be that anymore.
Amongst that network of sacred sites that the Winnemem still take care of in the McLeod River watershed, there's one place that we feature in the film. It's a rock called Puberty Rock, which sits right on the edge of the river. And because of Shasta Dam, that rock is underwater much of the year. And it's part of a coming-of-age ceremony that the Winnemem still do. And last summer, they initiated a young girl who is to be the future leader of the tribe. And every year, the tribe has to fight the Forest Service for access and to keep the, you know, gawkers in the motorboats away. But this rock is an example of one of many sacred sites, but it's a place where young girls learn to become women by learning how to grind the medicines and grind the teas. And this is a rock that will be permanently underwater if the U.S. government raises Shasta Dam by 18.5 feet, which is the current proposal, which is one of the things we talk about in the film. It's sort of part of this unbelievably complicated California water scheme that's going on. But the water is all for Southern California, Westlands Water District, maybe fracking. So you have this cultural touchstone that they can only access if the lake level from Shasta goes down enough in June and July when the flowers and the moon are right. And it's a beautiful ritual. And so they're fighting to protect this one rock and many other sacred sites against this crazy proposal to make a dam higher in an era where we're taking dams down, and to get more water to sell to suburban sprawl in Southern California. And what's odd about it, this for me, is that in the 80s, when they proposed that peripheral canal, it was a statewide issue. There was an election. It was voted down. And now the concept of, you know, Jerry Brown wants to put these two tunnels through the Delta to send more water to the South. And it's barely on the radar screen. It's like very few people really know about it. And it's all linked to raising Shasta Dam, which would flood the Winnemem sacred sites a second time, because they were flooded out in the 1940s already once.
Right. And then in addition to that, and we'll talk about this later, you're also very concerned about fracking, and you're fighting water bottling companies over the drying up of the sacred spring. So there's a lot of issues that you're dealing with, and we'll talk about that after the break. But first, I just wanted to get in a caller. Let's hear from Mike in Berkeley. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. In my experience, sacred lands are honored generally by not going there for most people. So I think that a sacred land should be a place that nobody is allowed to go, no human beings. And it should be official. Humans should be unselfish enough to allow that kind of thing to happen.
Well, thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts on that? Because a lot of people say, well, in order to appreciate the land and fight to preserve it, people need to see what it looks like and feel it. Where do you stand, Kellyn?
To some degree, the tribes or the indigenous peoples are connected to those places, and those places wait to see us and hear our songs and hear the language and hear what's going on as much as we need to be there. And so while I don't think that every race of population has that kind of responsibility to that place, is different than going to a park or different than going for a hike or, you know, just looking at the outdoors. But when you're going there for a purpose that is ancient way of existence, then that puts you in a different, responsibility to and for the place.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about the 4-part documentary series called Standing on Sacred Ground. What does sacred land mean today? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on KALW. If you'd like to join today's conversation or you have a question you'd like to ask, please get in touch by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email a question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the Supreme Court's first big case this term. At issue is whether limits on campaign contributions by individuals violate the First Amendment. Depending on how this goes, we can see even more money spent on political races. And then we'll also talk about the protests in Sudan over gas prices. On Monday, we'll talk about the value of online comment forums on news and information websites. Today, we are talking about a new four-part documentary series called Standing on Sacred Ground. And the film focus on eight indigenous communities around the world that are working to protect their traditional sacred lands from things like government mega projects, resource extraction, climate change, tourism, and consumer culture. And there are a number of screenings coming up. Let's see here. Debuting tonight through the weekend at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and then at the David Brower Center in Berkeley on Tuesday the 15th, and at the Roxy in San Francisco on the 16th and the 17th. And you can find information about all of the screenings at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Toby McLeod. He circled the globe for 7 years filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series. He founded the Sacred Land Film Project at the Earth Island Institute in 1984 to make documentaries relevant to indigenous communities and modern audiences. Kellyn Sisk is chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe in Northern California. Kellyn is currently battling a U.S. proposal to enlarge the Shasta Dam and flood the Winnemem sacred sites. The tribe is documented and recognized by the California Native American Heritage Commission, but it's been considered unrecognized by the U.S. government since 1985. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions for Toby about his experience traveling 7 years around the globe and meeting so many people who are fighting to preserve their land, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you have questions for Kellyn about what she's facing in Shasta and the Winnemem Wintu tribe, everything from fracking to taking on water bottling companies over the drying up of their spring. And then what about that term sacred? What does that really mean today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you've been in a movement to protect land, if you live near sacred land, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we move on, do you have anything else to add when Mike called in saying that no human should be allowed to enter sacred land?
I would say
that, Toby, go ahead.
I'd say that recognizing that within some Native communities, they do have rules. For example, the spring at Mount Shasta, you have to be 16 to go up there. So there are cultural restrictions on these sacred places. I think it's really beautiful what Kellyn said about the interaction between these places and people, that that's part of the vitality and the power and the function and the way these places work. But my comment would be that I have found it interesting watching the environmental movement evolve. David Brower, who was the first sponsor through Earth Island of my film project, who was an incredible mentor and a great person, in his era, protecting the earth meant creating wilderness areas that were roadless, where theoretically people really hadn't been much, and they should really mostly be kept out unless you had a backpack. And what's ironic now is that all these wilderness areas are being shown to have been managed ecosystems that indigenous people lived in and used all those years. The plants that are there are not there by chance. They're there, you know, if there's a whole grove of a certain kind of tree, or if there's a medicinal plant that's over here, they're not just kind of growing there. They've been managed for generations by indigenous people, and there was always fire management, so there weren't big fires. So these places that we have protected as wilderness, where you restrict people, indigenous people are finally getting the message through that these are not places where people just shouldn't go. People have been there forever, and we, you know what, need access still to go there and do our ceremonies, because there's a sacred place in there that you guys don't even know about. So very complicated history in a lot of these places.
And what about law? Is there a legal status for sacred lands under U.S. law?
No, it's very complicated. I mean, one of the reasons that we made these films is that in 1979, the government made a great effort called the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, which recognized, you know what, for 100 years we've been outlawing and repressing indigenous ceremonies and religion. So we should get over that, reverse that, and recognize the religious freedom of indigenous people. And then when Native people tried to use that law in court to protect the San Francisco Peaks and other places where the Kachina spirits live and so forth, the law failed to protect the sacred places because the judges kept saying, well, you are free to believe about these places, but that doesn't involve practicing and protecting the places in the place that you need, because Christianity, the dominant culture, doesn't get that. A church is sacred, not a mountain. It's really dangerous to private property and capitalism and mining and oil and gas, who are now free to, you know, go on federal lands this week, to acknowledge that kind of a right for indigenous people. But so no, there are cultural heritage laws, there are various environmental laws, and you know, you can protect a burial site, an archaeological site. But one of the things we're trying to do at the film project is craft language guided by indigenous lawyers and spiritual leaders that could work in the U.S. legal system and in Ethiopia and in Peru, that would recognize that these areas have spiritual significance and that the rules should be different and should be managed differently. And there now are National Park Service superintendents who are Native American. There are people in positions of authority who are moving this whole thing forward. And so there's, you know, there's an evolution of consciousness. And I think the legal language is really tricky for indigenous people because the whole legal system is set up to protect property,
right,
and not, you know, pagan religion, which is kind of what the legal system sees this as. Right?
What about California law? Do we have anything here protecting sacred land, Colleen?
We have not found it.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, is this something you're in dialogue with? Do politicians, I mean...
As much as we can be, but all of those things, you know, it takes money and
lobbying.
And people in academics that understand both the culture and the law, which are very few, if any. I mean, in our culture, in the Winnemem Wintu people, you know, you can count the number of people who have degrees on your hands. And so it's more difficult for indigenous populations to be able to defend their own by using the laws or even trying to change the laws to protect these places. You know, it's pretty difficult when you take a population that, you know, for California, the first governor wanted to exterminate all the Indians.
Right.
And then wanted to capture them and send them to school and strip them of all of that they knew, to now you can go to public school where nobody wants you, to now it's like, well, why aren't you guys educated?
And that was state policy.
That was state policy.
Right.
But when I look at it, it's like the McLeod River was one of the rivers in California that my people fought to keep mining out. And they were successful. And so now the McLeod River is one of the world-class fishing rivers because there was no mining. But nobody thanks us for doing that.
How did you do that?
Oh, it's a canyon river. And so it was remote for the time. And we were notorious about defending our territory. And so what needed to be done was done.
That is Colleen Sisk, chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe. They inhabit ancestral territory from Mount Shasta down to the McLeod River watershed. When the Shasta Dam was constructed during World War II, it flooded their home and blocked the salmon runs. The tribe is recognized in the state of California, but it's considered unrecognized by the U.S. government. Toby McLeod circled the globe for 7 years, filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series. These documentaries debut tonight at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and they will also be shown at the David Brower Center in Berkeley on the 15th and at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on the 16th and 17th. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. When we say sacred land or sacred ground, what does that mean to you? And if you are in the environmental movement, do these issues come up when you're talking about the relationship between the land and indigenous communities? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Buell in Oakland. Hi, Buell. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. When I was very young, I was taught that we are stewards of the land, of the ground. And when we would go camping, back when I was little, a lot of these places that we had gone were pristine, beautiful places. And, you know, we would take it all in. It was a place that we could decompress. And we wouldn't take radios and TVs because it was a time for us to commune and talk to one another and air things out. And more now when I go camping, I find that people have no respect of the land anymore. We go there, but our first line is, you know, when we cross it, we say, okay, there's a can, there's a bottle, let's get it all up. Because when we leave it better than we found it. And that's what I was taught when I was a child. But it doesn't seem like many other people are taught the same thing. And it's sad and it's heartbreaking to see people, you know, go in these areas that were pristine, beautiful, and you could just really smell the life in those areas. And, you know, God bless the people that, you know, would protect those lands from, you know, people that had no respect of it. But I know how progress is, and I know going to Bowman up in the Sierras, you know, it used to be rugged. Now it's all paved. So, you know, more and more people just go in there with passenger cars and, you know, TVs and stereos.
So Buell, how do we deal with this?
You know what? I know one thing is that, you know, I can't make anybody do right. So I've got to impress my kids. I've got to impress my friends to do what's right. So I influence my area of influence. And if everybody would just do that, just their friends, their family, influence them, you know, everybody would touch somebody, you know, going camping. When we're up there and we're talking to other people up there, you know, we're sharing with them, hey, you know, we're stewards of this land.
Yeah.
If we want our kids to come back, got to take care of it.
Thank you so much for calling in. Toby, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, one of the questions we get is, why is sacred land relevant to a modern audience? You know, why should anybody care about this? How do you make a film that actually conveys something relevant to people in a world that he just described as degraded, and we all feel it? And in my view, you know, the problem is that technology has run rampant with no value system or spiritual dimension to rein it in and balance it out, sort of something that I think all native cultures have as part of their worldview is this need for balance and the danger of imbalance, particularly in the direction of materialism. And I think we all feel this now. I think there's a psychic hunger and grieving and disconnect that we all know is going on. It's actually made worse by our cell phones, you know, the way we're all looking down all the time, and even though we're all using them, this psychic disconnection. And I think that these places that transform us or that Native people say are important, actually, and the people who protect them have part of the answer. The value system, the willingness to just be quiet and listen, to talk to the earth, to read the signs that nature gives. And people have all experienced that, these synchronicities, these things that give us, that change the direction we're going. And we go, oh, that was not really, that didn't feel like a coincidence. You know, that felt like it changed the course of my life. And did it have to do with that place? And Native people might say, oh, yeah, that happens there every 3 or 4 years. Somebody has that experience in that same place. But in my mind, as we've made this film, there are these images that come back to me now as we've finished editing. It's kind of a magical process. But we keep seeing thoughtful scientists listening to and collaborating with traditional knowledge holders and putting together their own sense of what's wrong and where do we need to go. And it's transformative. And I don't think that's been done much. I think that's historically actually a new thing, that people who have this kind of knowledge and wisdom are being recognized as, well, you don't have a PhD, but you got generations of wisdom behind you. And this is a way to rein in technology and heal the grieving that, I mean, you were telling us off air, you went to Big Sur on a backpacking trip last weekend, and the leader thanked the place and thanked the native people who'd been there. And it was kind of weird for all the participants, but that's a great thing that when we work out of the David Brower Center, and after 6 or 7 months of the building being up, people started feeling a little uncomfortable. They felt they needed a local native leader. Anne Marie Sayers, Ohlone Heritage, came in and just asked that the spirits of the place and the ancestors of all of us would sort of guide everyone in the building who was trying to protect the earth in a good way, because we were in this building and it didn't feel right. We needed permission. We needed a blessing. We needed to start in the right way. And 40 years ago, that never would have happened, but it was really a powerful experience.
There seems to be, Kaleen, a major connection, more connection between Indigenous cultures and non-Indigenous cultures with the Idle No More movement, and especially in Canada. They're doing some amazing things in Canada. But do you feel like there are more connections being made? Do you feel like people are talking more than they used to?
Yeah, I do think that there is a crossing of information. I'm not sure that there's an understanding that's actually taking place. We hope that it would, because in that understanding, then maybe people who will be in charge of future will make better decisions than what is going on right now. You know, because the destruction that's happening right now may change the world forever, and it's the future generations who will pay the cost, just like us, who were the future generations at the time of the Shasta Dam. We're that future generation, and we are not allowed on our river freely. Who would ever think that? I mean, my elders, my people never thought that the Winnemem would be homeless from their river, nor would the salmon never run in the river again.
Because of the Shasta Dam construction.
Yes. We both suffered, and the salmon and us suffered the same destruction in building the Shasta Dam.
You know, you mentioned Idle No More. It's an amazing movement in Canada, and it's really grounded in a kind of an Indigenous political movement. It's been one of the interesting things about the Keystone XL pipeline battle that's been going on sort of within this weird frame of just the United States that I found really interesting, because our film segment on the tar sands shows the cancer, the fish deformities, the effect on the traditional treaty rights and the health of these Indigenous communities that live there. And the Keystone XL pipeline movement, to some extent, has incorporated a little bit of that, but it's mostly about there's going to be leaks, it's going to pollute the Ogallala Aquifer, you know, and it's all important environmental information. But the real moral crime that's going on around tar sands is the effect on Indigenous people and their land rights, and that's not been a part of the movement, really, to stop that pipeline. And there's a disconnect still in the environmental movement's kind of respect for, understanding of these Indigenous communities that are affected by these different environmental disasters that are going on around us, like the raising of Shasta Dam.
Yeah, there was actually a Global Day of Action this week with Idle No More. People all around the globe took part to stand up for Indigenous communities. Let's go to our next caller, and thank you again, Buell, for calling in. Let's hear from Spreck in Oakland. Hi, Spreck.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call, and thanks for doing this program.
Thank you.
And I really love the comment that I think Toby made about putting down your cell phone and reestablishing an emotional connection with the land. I think we all really need to do that.
If you go to Big Sur, there's no connection at all. So even if you want to pick up your phone, you can't. I highly recommend it.
I'm sure they're building a tower this
no,
week.
No, let's hope not.
And we are in the era of dam removal and making some tough choices about how to manage our land and water. But there's one thing that sort of stuck in my craw a little bit, a comment Toby made. I'm personally involved in an effort to restore the Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite National Park. And I hear Toby twice complain about water going to Southern California. And from my perspective, the worst miscreants was the city of San Francisco when they put this dam in an iconic valley in Yosemite in 1923, and that's something that I think needs to be undone. And so, but it just bothers me when people suddenly just go right to Southern California and blame them when folks up here have done a lot of damage as well.
Well, I'm a Giants fan, and I'm a big kind of Northern California, you know, knee jerk. I got my own kind of racist thing going there that's irrational. But for me, the model is extractive resource exploitation by cities that reach into these remote areas like Hetch Hetchy, or in the case of the Hopi, you know, Phoenix and Las Vegas, going out and coal strip mining in a way that you would never do in, near your homeland. But because it's like a sacrifice area out there in Hetch Hetchy Valley or the McLeod River or out in the tar sands area, that's kind of the metaphor that we've tried to use in the film, is this idea that material culture would sacrifice these living ecosystems and peoples for our consumer habits. And as consumers, we need to take responsibility for what we've destroyed, like Hetch Hetchy Valley, or, you know, like the McLeod River, the people, the salmon, everything. And I don't think we realize the cost of all of this technology and all of these comforts that we have.
Well, the other thing that was striking about the film is, and again, Toby, you spent 7 years filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series, and Kalene, you went with Toby to the Republic of Altai in Russia for the debut. And so many of these struggles are so similar. What was it like for you to meet the indigenous activists there and then to see these indigenous activists in five different places around the globe and just look at the similarities?
Yeah, I think that going to the Altai, and of course, some of the Altaians came to our village as well and connected with us, but we didn't have the same experience until just recently going to their village to see that, yes, in fact, we are pretty similar. Even our house structure of our prayer place is pretty similar. And the way that we think about the mountains or the water or our obligations and responsibilities to it and for it are pretty similar. And we all have lost a lot over the years of, you know, people's prosperity and their ability to boost themselves up at the expense of cultures and the environment. And the resources that are there, like for us, the salmon, and in New Zealand is the eels, and in the Altai, you know, have the same kind of issues that we are still hanging on to. It's like, we have to do something about this. Hmm. We can't just let it all slip away.
Well, and I was wondering how you maintain your hope, or you keep up this fight at a time when you're dealing with the dam, you're dealing with the salmon, you're dealing with fracking, the water bottling companies, these ceremonies. how do you keep going?
Well, I have a glimmer of hope when I see Idle No More and I saw Occupy. Mm. And I wish Occupy would come back and try again. And when both Toby McLeod and Will Doolittle doing such good work with indigenous populations and showing a story or a life, you know, even though it's a snippet in time, of lives that we are a part of and have been here, you know, in our history, it's over 6,000 years that they've documented us. And now, you know, they say we're unrecognized. What is that? Mm. How does a country unrecognize its indigenous people after they recognized us for the extermination policy and the, you know, the boarding school policy and the taking of our land policies, and now all of a sudden we're unrecognizable?
And again, the Winnemem-Wintu tribe is recognized in the state of California, but not by the U.S. government. And we have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Raman in Oakland. Hi, Raman. Hello? Raman, are you there? All right, sorry about that. He wanted to talk about the letter from Chief Seattle to Congress that was written back in the 1800s. Says the president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land, but how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? So thank you for that, Raman. And Toby, because you spent so much time with indigenous communities, where do you find hope? What's exciting you about these movements around the globe?
Well, now that we're finished with the film, the thing that's exciting to me is, and we're going to experience it over the next few days, is the coming together of the different guardians of sacred places. There's been enough financial support in the last 10 or 20 years for different communities to travel to the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues or around different issues. And in this case, there's quite a few Native people who guard sacred places and care for them coming together to talk about what are we going to do together. And for me, to see these stories in a dire, you know, world of climate change and no one knowing what to do, to allow these Native leaders to have the time and space to talk and figure out their common problems and the ways they would address them together and to partner with allies is very exciting to me. Because I think when Kalin went to the Altai, there's a sense of, oh my God, we're dealing with the same mega, you know, like they want to build a gas pipeline across the sacred burials and over, and now they're,
and this is in Russia.
In Russia. Yeah. So there's a sense of, oh boy, we're really up against it. But there's also strength in the kind of knowing that there are other people who are standing up, doing everything they can think of out of this cultural obligation. And I think when you bring them from Hawaii and you bring them from Ethiopia and you get together and you share these experiences, something new is going to come from that, because the planet is sacred. That's underneath this whole issue. And how do we protect the whole planet with traditional knowledge and these incredibly brilliant people who've been ignored for so long actually leading and being at the table and guiding how we get out of this problem that we've created?
Toby McLeod circled the globe for 7 years filming the Standing on Sacred Ground series. Kalin Sisk is chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe in Northern California, and their story is told. These films premiere today and through the weekend at the Mill Valley Film Festival. They'll be shown at the David Brower Center in Berkeley on Tuesday the 15th and at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on the 16th and the 17th. And you can find information about the premieres at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for coming in.
Oh. Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the Supreme Court's first big case this term. At issue is whether limits on campaign contributions by individuals violate the First Amendment. We'll also talk about protests in Sudan. We'll be joined by The Nation's Lee Fang, The Huffington Post's Paul Blumenthal, and freelance journalist Ishmael Kushkush. Where did you see the best reporting this week? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.